Postmodernism continues to attract our attention. We've had presentations on this in the past. But I'm always amazed at the difficulty in putting your arms around the whole concept of postmodernism and all the different definitions of it, and whether it's philosophy or architecture or whatever it might be. We're fortunate to have Jim Filler, adjunct instructor at Eastman, to talk about this topic today. Jim took graduate classes in philosophy at the University of Dallas and also studied philosophy at a graduate level for 1 year at the Catholic University in Leuven, Belgium. His focus in graduate school was on the broad history of philosophy. He is in his fourth year of teaching at Eastville. He also taught at El Central for a year. And then, where else did you teach?
Tarrant County
Junior College, teaching in Northwest. And so, anyway, he's got quite a bit of teaching experience in the realm of philosophy. So please join me in welcoming Jim Filler.
Thank you. To get started, I'd like to read an article I saw in the Dallas Morning News 4 weeks ago. By Larry Pitts, called Facts or Stubborn Claims, but they're still facts. It says, I got an email the other day that depressed me. It concerned a piece I recently did that mentioned Andrew Johnson, who was awarded the French Croix de Guerre. Somebody speak French. In World War I, for single-handedly fighting off a company of Germans. Some accounts say there were 14, some say almost 30. The ones I find the most authoritative say there were about 2 dozen, who threatened to overrun his post. Johnson managed this despite the fact that he was only 5'4" and 130 pounds, despite the fact that his gun jammed, despite the fact that he was wounded 21 times. My mention of Johnson's heroics drew a review from a fellow named Ken Thompson, which I quote verbatim and in its entirety. Hate to tell you that blacks were not allowed into combat until 1947. That fact, World War II ended in 1945. So all that feel good, one black man killing 2 dozen Nazis, is just that PC bull. In response, my assistant, Judy Smith, sent Mr. Thompson proof of Johnson's heroics, a link to his page on the website of Arlington National Cemetery. She thought this settled the matter. Thompson's reply, there is no race on headstones and they didn't come up with the story until 2002. Judy, I guess you can choose to believe Arlington National Cemetery or not. Thompson, it is what it is. You don't believe either. At this point, Judy forwarded me their correspondence along with a despairing note. You see, like me, she can remember a time when facts settled arguments. This is back before everything became a partisan shouting match. Back before it was permissible to ignore or deride as bias anything that didn't support your worldview. If you and I had an argument and I produced facts from an authoritative source to back me up, you couldn't just blow that off. You might try to undermine my facts, might counter my facts with facts of your own, but you couldn't just pretend my facts had no weight or meaning. But that's the intellectual state of the Union these days, as evidenced by all the people who still don't believe that the president was born in Hawaii, or that the planet is warming, and by Mr. Thompson, who doesn't believe Henry Johnson did what he did. I could send him a recruit. Johnson has lauded his history books and contemporary accounts. I could also point out that blacks have fought in every war in American history, but before Harry Truman did it, desegregated the military in 1948, they did so with Jim Crow units. Also, there were no Nazis in World War I. Those are facts, and facts will only mean what they want to. I suppose I could also ignore it. But you see, Ken Thompson is not just some isolated eccentric. No, he is the zeitgeist of the top five. To listen to talk radio, to watch TV pundits, to read newspapers, online message boards, is to realize that we are people that estranged from critical thinking, divorced from logic, alienated from even objective truth. We admit no ideas that do not confirm us, hear no voices that do not echo us, sift out all information that does not validate what we wish to believe. I submit that any people thus handicapped sow the seeds of their own decline. They respond to the world as they wish it were, rather than the world as it is. But objective reality does not change because you refuse to accept it. The fact that you refuse to acknowledge a wall does not change the fact that it's a wall, and you shouldn't have to hit it to find that out. Well, there's a couple things that interest me.
What
did
you say?
That's right.
What? Uh-oh. Yeah. There's a couple things that I find interesting about this article. I mean, it's not Ken Thompson's apparent mere rationality. It's Mr. Pitt's response. Because we follow, at least I've done with students that say completely wacky stuff in classroom. You know, we see that it's not the same knowledge that you have to be true. knowledge of something, and even thoughts. Great question. Filling out this policy.
Can't hear you. You can't hear me? I think I need to move.
Well, not necessarily. Maybe I just need to talk about it.
Let's take and put this over here.
There we go. What interests me is that he recognizes Ken Thompson as more than just an isolated case. He represents the zeitgeist, the intellectual current currently in our society. Now, what is this zeitgeist? I would argue that it's postmodernism, and that's what I'm going to argue. Now, I disagree with Mr. Pitts when he says that this zeitgeist... Okay. Well, let me try the microphone next. Is it on?
It's on.
Check, check, check. Check, check, check. Nope, it's not on. Check, check. Okay. Is that better? Okay. I disagree with Mr. Pitts when he says that the current zeitgeist is a divorce from logic and an estrangement from critical thinking, because I think it's critical thinking and logic that's actually gotten us to this point. And that's what I'm going to try and point out tonight. One thing to note before we get started, because what I'm going to focus on when I talk about postmodernism is its attitude towards knowledge and truth. We already heard that there's a lot of different areas of postmodernism, architecture, literature, but from a philosophical perspective, I'm going to argue, talk about its attitude towards knowledge and truth, because I think all the other stuff can come out of that if we understand it properly. But what is postmodernism? As we already heard, that's also difficult to define. Defining a system of thought that distrusts absolutes is by definition going to be problematic. Because as soon as you define it, then you're attaching an absolute to it, and they already reject absolutes. So how are we going to define it? Well, Jean-Francois Lyotard defines postmodernism as incredulity towards meta-narratives. Now what does that mean? Well, basic meaning of meta-narratives is just going to be it's a narrative about narratives. But what are narratives? Narrative, according to David Herman, is a fundamental way of organizing human experience and a tool for constructing models of reality. A narrative, I would argue, is a way of, or a story, that's what narrative is, it's a story to explain a certain thing. There's narratives about epistemology in philosophy, narratives about ethics. Meta-narrative would be an overarching narrative that establishes the validity of the different narratives underneath. What makes a narrative valid? Oops, now how do I go back? Okay. And this is... Please. Okay, I'll go early, but that's okay. In Lyotard's explanation, he says the obsolescence of the meta-narrative apparatus of legitimation corresponds to the crisis of metaphysical philosophy. Now, what's he talking about there? What is metaphysical philosophy? Metaphysical philosophy is the philosophy that understands being or reality. And prior to Descartes, metaphysical philosophy was the primary philosophy. It was the first question everybody asked. What is being? What is reality? And after you answered that question, then everything else fell into place. Questions about what it meant to be ethical came after metaphysics. Questions about what it meant to know something came after metaphysics. We've already seen that to a certain extent with Mr. Pitts, because he equates objective reality and objective truth. Well, how can we do that? Well, it's because truth, in a fundamental sense, corresponds to reality. What is true is determined by what's real. It's true that we're all sitting here at Chick in Barcelona because reality is that we are sitting here at Chick in Barcelona. that we're sitting here in, you know, Chili's is false, because we're not really sitting here in Chili's. So, and that's our common sense theory of truth, and it's called the correspondence theory of truth. There's another theory of truth called the coherence theory of truth, which has become predominant fairly recently, traced back, the sources I saw said, to the mid-17th century, which state that a statement is true if it's consistent within a given set of propositions or within a certain system of thought. Now, what consistency means in that context can vary. Some people say the propositions entail a statement. If they entail a statement, then it's true. But whatever, it's consistent within the set of propositions, and those set of propositions determine the truth of statements. So in a different system, a different statement could have a different truth value. And that's going to be the result of this metaphysical crisis that Lyotard talks about. Question? What? So what is metaphysics? Metaphysics is understanding of being. And going back to the pretty much the beginnings of philosophy, and we talk about the pre-Socratics and look at the two basic understandings of beings, you have Heraclitus, whose philosophy was that everything is constantly changing. His famous statement is, you can't step into the same river twice. His disciple modified that and said, you can't even step into the same river once. Why not? Because it's always changing. And as soon as you step into it, it's not the same river anymore. Parmenides is the other one. And his statement is that all being is one. And that there is no change, there is no motion, there is no difference. And he says this by stating things either are, there is either that it is or that it is not. And if it is not, then we can't talk about it, because you can't talk about nothing. So by definition, if it's nothing, then you have nothing to say about it, and so there's nothing. So this means there's no change, because if there's two beings, if there's two things, then there's something one of them is not. And since we can't talk about what is not, we can't talk about difference. Same thing goes for motion, because if there's something moves and there's some place that is not, we can't talk about what is not. So motion is impossible. And it ends up being, being is one, eternal, it can't come into being, it can't perish, and all these other attributes. Plato, both of these views have problems. Heraclitus is obvious, or should be obvious, and Plato deals with it in the dialogue with Theaetetus, where he's examining what knowledge is. He looks at Protagoras, he says man is the measure of all things, and ties Heraclitus into this, and says, if everything's always changing, if man is the measure of all things, then I can believe anything I want to believe. It just depends on my perspective. If everything's always changing, then nothing is true. Because as soon as I claim I know it, then it's changed and it's now false. Right? So knowledge is impossible if Heraclitus is right. Well, Parmenides seems to be better, because he doesn't have the problem with everything constantly changing, but his problem is a little different. If everything's one and there is no difference and there's no change at all, then how can I know anything either? Because knowledge presupposes, at least at its most basic level, a distinction between the knower and the object known. So either way, you're going to have problems with knowledge, not to mention the other problems with Parmenides, that if motion is not possible, how do we get here? Who am I talking to? All these other questions. But he has his own disciple, Zeno, who came up with all these paradoxes to prove that Parmenides was right. Well, Plato takes a middle ground. Plato takes a middle ground and says, well, neither one of them can be completely right, although he likes Parmenides better. So he comes up with this theory of the forms. And basically what the theory of the forms is, you're probably familiar with it, but I'll go over it anyway, is all the difference in the world that I perceive, all the multiplicity, that's not really real. That's just a shadow world. What's real is the form, the one thing, that stands up above it and exists apart from it, and makes the thing what it is. What makes the table a table, what makes that table and this table, even though they're two different things, both a table, the form tableness. Because they both participate in this one thing. And then from that theory, his metaphysical theory, then he derives theories about what it means to be good, what it means to be have knowledge, because we've already seen how knowledge is tied to this. Well, it goes this way until Descartes. And Descartes's a turning point in the history of philosophy. Probably, I argue that he's the most important philosopher because he screwed everything up. And he begins his questioning by trying to find out what he can know for certain. He lives in a very chaotic time. In the 1450s, the printing press was invented, which led to the Protestant Reformation. I would argue the Reformation couldn't have happened without the printing press. And in 1543, Copernicus wrote his book, throwing the worldview totally on its head. So the authority that had been established up to this point, the church, is now being challenged both on religious fronts and on scientific grounds. The worldview has changed and the religious authority is being challenged. Descartes writes his book in 1641, about 100 years after all this is happening, and he's living in a world where all this stuff is going on. So how are we going to get rid of all this chaos? How are we going to establish anything for certain? So he looks at it and says, reason shows me that I should withhold my assent no less carefully from things which are not plainly certain and indubitable than I would to what is patently false. It will be sufficient justification for rejecting them all if I find a reason for doubting even the least of them. He comes up with a method called hyperbolic doubt. He's going to doubt everything. Because unless he's certain about something, he says we aren't justified in believing it. So what does he doubt? Well, he begins with his senses. My senses seem obvious to me. But it may be said, perhaps, that although the senses occasionally mislead us respecting minute objects and such as are so far removed from us as to be beyond the reach of close observation, and what he's talking about there is things that are so small that you can't really see them, or things like, you know, the sun. If you look at the sun, how big is the sun? If you look at it, well, it looks to be about that big. Well, we all know it's not that big, so the senses are deceiving us. Or a stick in a glass of water looks broken, and it's not really broken, and we all know it's not broken. But the senses, from the senses, it appears that that's the case. So, although the senses occasionally mislead us respecting minute objects and such as are so far removed from us as to be beyond the reach of close observation, there are yet many other of their informations or presentations, the truth of which it is manifestly impossible to doubt. As, for example, that I am in this place, seated by the fire, clothed in a winter dressing gown, and I hold in my hands this piece of paper with other intimation of the same nature. What's he saying? Well, yeah, okay. My senses might deceive me about strange stuff like the size of the sun, but the fact that I'm standing here in the Chick of Barcelona talking to you guys about Descartes and postmodernism, I can't doubt that, can I? I mean, that seems pretty obvious.
To doubt what?
To doubt that I'm standing here talking to you guys. Though this may be true, I must nevertheless here consider that I am a man, and that consequently I am in the habit of sleeping, and representing to myself in dreams those same things, or even sometimes others less probable, which the insane think are presented to them in their waking moments. How often have I dreamt that I was in these familiar circumstances, that I was dressed and occupied this place by the fire, when I was lying undressed in bed. At the present moment, however, I certainly look upon this paper with eyes wide awake. The head which I now move is not asleep. I extend this hand consciously and with express purpose, and I perceive it. The occurrences in sleep are not so distinct as all this. But I cannot forget that at other times I have been deceived in sleep by similar illusions, and attentively considering those cases, I perceive so clearly that there exist no certain marks by which the state of waking can be distinguished from that of sleep that I feel greatly astonished. How do I know I'm not sleeping? How do I know y'all aren't just a dream?
That's before the Matrix, too.
There have been a lot of movies made about this stuff. Twilight Zone does it all the time.
Pain?
Haven't you ever had pain when you were asleep?
Not
a dream. No? Well, I have.
So you got off your medicine?
Possibly. It's not just dreams. I mean, now we can talk about chemical alterations in the brain. LSD, something like that, causes hallucinations. But how do I know I'm not dreaming? And according to Descartes, if I can't be absolutely certain of something, then I'm not justified in assenting to it. I'm not justified in believing it. Because if it could possibly be wrong, then I need to take that into account and withhold my assent. So, okay. Everything I perceive may be a dream. Well, there are other things, even in my dreams, that don't change. For example, even in my dreams, the images that I have, those are made up of other things, right? Colors, shapes, size, and those exist whether I'm sleeping or awake. Or a better example might be mathematical principles. 2 plus 3 equals 5. Have you ever had a dream where 2 plus 3 equaled 8? Or a square had 6 sides? No. Even in my dreams, whether I'm awake or asleep, a square has 4 sides, a triangle has 3 sides, and all the angles add up to 180 degrees. And 2 plus 3 equals 5. So whether I'm asleep or awake, this seems to be the case. We will not, therefore, perhaps reason illegitimately if we conclude from this that physics, astronomy, medicine, and all the other sciences that have for their end the consideration of composite objects are indeed of a doubtful character, but that arithmetic, geometry, and the other sciences of the same class, which regard merely the simplest and most general objects, and scarcely inquire whether or not these are really existent, contain somewhat that is certain and indubitable. For whether I'm awake or dreaming, it remains true that 2 and 3 make 5. And that a square has but 4 sides. Nor does it seem possible that truth so apparent can ever fall under a suspicion of falsity or incertitude. So we've got something we can hang our hat on. Yeah? Mathematical principles. We can be certain of those. Whether I'm awake or sleeping, I can be certain of those, yeah? Well, not so fast. Nevertheless, the belief that there is a God who is all-powerful and who created me such as I am has for a long time obtained steady possession of my mind. How then do I know that he has not arranged that there should be neither earth nor sky nor any extended thing, nor figure, nor magnitude, nor place, providing at the same time, however, for the rising of these perceptions of all these objects and the persuasion that these do not exist otherwise than as I perceive them. And further, as I sometimes think that others are in error respecting matters of which they believe themselves to possess a perfect knowledge, how do I know that I am not also deceived each time I add together 2 and 3, or number the sides of a square, or form some judgment still more simple, if more simple indeed can be imagined? This is what's called the evil genius. Didn't turn out very good. I had to enlarge it too much. And it scares me a little bit, so I'm going to go on. Is it possible that there's some evil genius out there making me believe that 2 plus 3 equals 5? That a square has 4 sides, and that these things aren't really the case. Is it possible? Well, it would seem to be. I can't prove that it's not the case. So I am constrained at last to avow that there is nothing at all that I formerly believed to be true of which it is impossible to doubt, so that henceforward, if I desire to discover anything certain, I ought not the less carefully to refrain from assenting to those same opinions into what might be shown to be manifestly false. So what's left for me to believe in? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. There's not anything. So everything can possibly be done. Either I could be dreaming, or on a bad LSD trip, or God could be deceiving me. Yeah? But again, not so fast. But I had the persuasion that there was absolutely nothing in the world, that there was no sky and no earth, neither minds nor bodies. Was I not therefore at the same time persuaded that I did not exist? Far from it. I assuredly existed since I was persuaded. But there is I know not what being who is possessed at once of the highest power and the deepest cunning, who is constantly employing all his ingenuity in deceiving me. Doubtless then I exist since I am deceived, and let him deceive me as he may, he can never bring it about that I am nothing, so long as I shall be conscious that I am something, so that it must in fine be maintained, all things being maturely and carefully considered, that this proposition, I am, I exist, is necessarily true each time as it is expressed by me or conceived in my mind. I think, therefore, I am. And that's what he's saying. The one thing it's not possible to doubt is that I exist and I think. Because even if I'm being deceived about that, even if I'm dreaming, I still think that these things are real. I think. Okay. So I think, therefore I am. But what does that give us? Well, not a whole lot. I still don't know if I have a body. I still don't know if 2 plus 3 equals 5. I still don't, you know, there's still maybe that ugly red guy up there making me think things that aren't real. I might be plugged up to a computer in the Matrix. I just don't know. So what do I need to do to get past this? I must inquire whether there is a God as soon as an opportunity of doing so shall present itself. And if I find that there is a God, I must examine likewise whether he can be a deceiver. For without the knowledge of these two truths, I do not see that I can ever be certain of anything. I have to know that God's not deceiving me in order to have any knowledge at all. Yeah? So how does he proceed to do this? Descartes' genius. Now it is manifest by the natural light, this gets a little complicated, it is manifest by the natural light that there must at least be as much reality in the efficient and total cause as in its effect. For whence can the effect draw its reality if not from its cause? What's he saying there? He's saying that in any effect, the reality in that effect can only come from its cause. And it can't get any reality it has any place except from what causes it. Because nothing can come from nothing, as Eric Idle said, hanging on the cause of even like a bun. And how could that cause communicate to it this reality unless it possessed it in itself? And hence it follows not only that what is cannot be produced by what is not, likewise that the more perfect, in other words, that which contains in itself more reality, cannot be the effect of the less perfect. And this is not only evidently true of those effects whose reality is actual or formal, but likewise of ideas whose reality is only considered as objective. Now, he's making a distinction here between formal and objective reality. The distinction is merely that ideas have objective reality, the amount of reality they have as an idea, and things have formal reality, the content, the reality they have in themselves. But you can't have objective reality in an idea unless there's something with that same formal reality that causes it. Now what's he talking about here? I have an idea of a perfect being, right? We all have an idea of a perfect being, whether we believe in that being or not. We have this idea of perfection. Now where did that idea come from? For Descartes, it has too much reality to have come from me. I couldn't have created the idea. Where would it have come from? I'm not perfect. As much as I would like to think so sometimes, I'm not perfect. So where would my idea of perfection come from? It has to come from a being that has perfect reality. Because no effect can have a higher degree of reality than what causes it. And if my idea of a perfect being came from me, then it would have more reality, a higher degree of reality than I have. And that's not possible. So the only thing that can explain the idea of God, according to Descartes, is God. But in order that an idea may contain this objective reality rather than that, it must doubtless derive from some cause in which is found at least as much formal reality as the idea contains an objective. For if we suppose that there is found in an idea anything which was not in its cause, it must of course derive this from nothing, which is what we just said. Whence it is sufficiently manifest that he cannot be a deceiver, since it is a dictate of the natural light that all fraud and deception spring from some defect. Well, the first thing we had to prove was that God existed. And so Descartes got that, with his, I have a perfect idea or an idea of a perfect being, and the only thing adequate to explain that idea is God himself. But the second thing they had to prove was that God does not deceive me. Because if God exists, but he's still up there poking around in my head, making me think things, then that doesn't help me much. But since deception and fraud spring from some defect, and God is perfect, then God can't be deceiving me. I'm saved. I can get out of my own head. I can move beyond I think, therefore I am. So now I know something exists apart from me, namely God. But that still doesn't help me much. What about the external world? Okay, so now I've got me and I got God. But what about the table? Is something that exists apart from me? Or me sitting here talking to you guys? Certainly considering the ideas of all these qualities, perceptible qualities, light, sound, taste, etc., which were presented to my mind, and which alone I properly and immediately perceived, it was not without reason that I thought and I perceived certain objects wholly different from my thought, namely bodies from which those ideas proceeded. for I was conscious that the ideas were presented to me without my consent being required, so that I could not perceive any object, however desirous it I might be, unless it were present to the organ of sense, and it was wholly out of my power not to perceive it when it was present. But I got a little ahead of myself. If God exists and doesn't deceive me, then that means I can basically rely on my faculties. Because where did my faculties come from? God gave it to me. So if my faculties fail, or if my faculties are flawed, then God's not perfect. Or else he's deceiving me. Neither of which can possibly be the case. So when I see something, because my clear and distinct ideas, when I perceive something clearly and distinctly, it must therefore exist, because if it didn't, God would be deceiving me, he'd be making my faculties all wacky, and they can't be wacky, or else he's deceiving. Now, okay, the truth is we have to examine how is it possible for us to make mistakes? How is it possible for me to perceive the sun that's only that big, or the stick that's broken in a glass of water, or to make any mistakes at all? Because it seems to apply that if God doesn't deceive me, and God's perfect, then I can't make any mistakes. Well, Descartes has a whole long explanation about how it's possible for us to make mistakes, but we don't need to go into that. But it is coherent with his theory. And basically what it comes down to is if it's possible for me to make mistakes, it has to be possible for me not to make mistakes. So as far as judgments go, as long as I don't assent to anything that I'm not certain about, I can never make a mistake. The ability to avoid mistakes completely exists within me. I can never make a mistake as far as my judgments go, if I want to.
Isn't he a victim of his own perfectionism?
How do you mean?
Those expectations right there, and that's reading and
reading.
He's a very, in that sense, a limited thinker.
What do you mean by limited?
Perfectionism, perfection, what is perfection? We arrive at perfection through experience and decide if this is not quite. I don't know about that. Excuse me.
That's okay. Yeah, I don't mind.
A little question and answer period.
Okay. I can answer it. We can deal with it now or later. I like when my students interrupt me, so it means I talk less, and that's always a good thing. So the other thing is my perceptions. Now I perceive things, and when I perceive them as something external to me. Because my perceptions lead me to believe that there's something out there, that my perceptions aren't just in my head. Right? Well, this is because my sensation is a passive faculty, as he's saying. The ideas are presented to me without my consent being required, so that I cannot perceive any object, however desirous I might be, unless it were present in the organ of sense. I can't make myself not perceive the table. And when I open my eyes, I perceive the table whether I want to or not. I can't turn the table into a dragon. I can't do anything else with the table as far as my perception goes. It just is what it is. Since God can't be a deceiver, got a couple of these. Moreover, I find in myself the diverse faculties of thinking that have each their special mode. For example, I find I possess the faculties of imagining and perceiving. It is very evident, however, that these faculties, if they really exist, must belong to some corporeal or extended substance. Farther, I cannot doubt but that there is in me a certain passive faculty of perception, that is, of receiving and taking knowledge of the ideas of sensible things. But this would be useless to me if they did not also exist in me, or in some other thing, another active faculty capable of forming and producing those ideas. But this faculty cannot be in me, because I'm a thinking thing. This doesn't have anything to do with thought, seeing that it does not presuppose thought. And also that those ideas are frequently produced in my mind without my contributing anything to it in any way, and even frequently contrary to my will. There's a lot of things I perceive that I don't want to perceive. This faculty must therefore exist in some substance different from me. Basically. But as God is no deceiver, it is manifest that he does not of himself immediately communicate those ideas to me, nor even by the intervention of any creature in which their objective reality is not formally, but only imminently contained. For as he has given me no faculty whereby I can discover this to be the case, but on the contrary, a very strong inclination to believe that those ideas arise from corporeal objects, I do not see how he could be vindicated from the charge of deceit if in truth they proceeded from any other source or were produced by any other causes than corporeal things. And accordingly, it must be concluded that corporeal objects exist. So now I've got my corporeal world. I've got my world outside my mind. I exist and I think. God exists and doesn't deceive me. And because God exists and doesn't deceive me, I know that there's a world that's out there. Thank God. Because otherwise I'm stuck in my head. And how do I get out of it?
So you're in a world where squares don't exist and where triangles either contain more than or less than 180 degrees, but where simple coverage does not predict results in complex chaos.
Or only two sides. Something has only two sides. So yeah. Well, there's a problem here. A little ahead of ourselves. There's a problem here. I mean, the I think, therefore I am. Remember, Descartes' standard is that I have to be absolutely certain about something, and by certain he means impossible to doubt, before I can assent to something. Okay, well, what about in his little demonstration here? Can we not doubt? Well, I think, and I exist. Okay, that's kind of hard to doubt. If I doubt my own existence, well, then all sorts of weird things happen. So I can't really doubt my own existence. But what about the argument for God's existence? Was that persuasive? Not to me. And I'm a theist. So, you know, I don't find it persuasive. And if God doesn't exist, then what happens to the external world? The external world disappears too. Because it was dependent on God to begin with. And him's going to argue against. Descartes said that we can only get our idea of perfection from a perfect God because how would I know that I was imperfect unless I had an understanding of what it meant to be perfect to compare myself to? Hume takes just the opposite path. He says, no, we get our idea of God from looking at our own limitations and then imagining that those limitations don't exist in some being. I can lift the paper. I have no problem lifting the paper. I can lift the table, although that's a little harder. If I go out and try and lift a car, I can maybe make it go up and down a little bit, but I'm not going to be able to lift it. If I try to lift a restaurant, then I'm not going to be able to do it at all. So I have some knowledge of my own limitations. And just by imagining those limitations didn't exist, that's where I get my understanding of perfection. That's at least as plausible as Descartes' argument for where we get the idea of a perfect God, isn't it? Truth is, it doesn't have to be as plausible as long as it can raise the least amount of doubt. Because within Descartes' system, if it can be doubted at all, then I'm not justified in believing. Yes?
I'm sorry. It seems like during this period of time, 200 years, people assumed that the human brain would have a roster completely empty, and you wrote off what you wanted, and wouldn't learn what you wanted, without realizing that you came with a brain and the body compelled by genes, by upbringing. And all these assumptions, you know, you try to hold them in.
Well, now Descartes is not going to believe that we're born tabula rasa. That's actually Locke.
I know Locke did. Yeah,
Descartes actually believes we have innate ideas.
Your head
ideas? We have innate ideas, yeah. That we're born with. We have innate ideas. Because those are the two competing theories we hear. Huh? Because we have an innate idea of a perfect being. It's one of our innate ideas. Where does it come from? We're created with it. Because God gives it to us. Because that's the only place it could come from for Descartes. Now Hume, like I said, takes a different tack. And Hume, I'm not going to go through everybody between Descartes and Nietzsche. But I want to talk a little bit about Hume and Kant, since they're important predecessors of Nietzsche. Hume is an empiricist. He says all our knowledge comes from experience. Well, there's a sounds good, except there's a problem with that. If I'm only going to accept my experience as a source of knowledge, then what knowledge do I actually have? What do my senses and what do my perceptions actually give me? When I look at a table, do I see a table? No, I see a bunch of sensations. I see a bunch of colors, shapes, sounds, you know, all tied to this. What makes it a table? All my perceptions give me a certain chaotic mess, basically. What forms it into a table? And Kant, this was important, cause and effect. When I hold a pen and I let it go, it falls. letting go of the pen causes it to fall. But from an experience standpoint, from a perspective of pure experience, what have I experienced? The only thing I've experienced with cause and effect is that one event happens and then another event happens. I don't experience any necessary connection between those two events. There's no necessary connection in my experience between letting go of the pen and the pen falling. I just let go of the pen, and then it's followed by the pen falling. It's no different than if I snap my fingers and the lights went out, or somebody knocked on the table. One event is followed by another. So what causes us to think one causes the other, that the pen falling is caused by letting it go? Well, this is habit. We get into the habit of expecting certain events. When I see somebody let go of the pen, I expect to see the pen fall. We become habituated to expect that. And that's all cause and effect is for us, because that's all we get from our experience. Kant saw this and he's like, wow, that's pretty profound. What am I going to do with this? This is where my phenomena and numinous stuff comes in. So Kant takes up King's challenge and says, okay, well, what is it? What makes me perceive a table when all my experience gives me is this jumbled bunch of mess? So that's the way the mind shapes my experience. That's the way the mind works. My mind has all these categories going on in there, and whenever it meets up with something, it applies all these categories to it, and it creates the phenomenon. See over there on the right? Phenomenon, which just means appearance. Have an appearance of the table. But where does the appearance exist? Where does the phenomena exist? Does it exist out there? No, it exists in my mind. What exists out there? Well, the only thing I have access to, according to Kant, is the phenomena. The noumena, which is what he calls the thing in himself, I don't know anything about that. I can't talk about it. I can't say anything about it. I can't know anything about it. I just have to assume it exists in order to explain the phenomena. Because without something out there, then I have to kind of assume that there would be no phenomena. Right? So the noumena, the thing out there, the external world, well, we have to assume it exists, or we can't know anything about it, can't speak about it, don't know anything about it. So metaphysics is getting tinier and tinier and tinier. And this is where we get Nietzsche. Nietzsche comes in quite a while after this, but after this. And this is the famous madman speech. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, "I seek God, I seek God." As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Has he got lost?" asked one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" asked another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage, immigrated?" Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Where there is God," he cried, "I will tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually and backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? Do we not need to light lanterns in the morning? Do we not hear nothing yet as of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? God's too decomposed. God is dead. God remains dead and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our eyes. Who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to recant? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed. And whoever is born after us for the sake of this deed, he will belong to a higher history than all history hitherto. Here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners. They too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern to the ground and it broke into pieces and went out. "I've come too early," he said then. "My time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering, It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is more distant from them than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves. It has been related further that on the same day the madman forced his way into several churches, and there struck up his Requiem Eternum Deo. But out and called to account, he is said always to have replied nothing but, "What after all of these churches now if they are not the tombs and sepulchres of God?" In my opinion, if you understand this epigram, you can understand all of Nietzsche's philosophy. Because what he's saying there, God is dead, he's not talking about a religious God, although that's included. What he's talking about is metaphysics. God is a metaphysical concept. At its most basic level, all understandings of God are as the Supreme Being. Well, the Supreme Being is a metaphysical concept that exists apart from us. For Descartes, existed apart from us. Now what happens when this Supreme Being, when this metaphysical principle disappears? Well, the horizon is gone. Where are we going? Backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Is there any standard of reverence to measure anything against without this metaphysical reality? And the answer is no, not an objective one. Because we've killed it. This, according to Nietzsche, is how it happened. How the true world became a fable. The true world, attainable for the sage, and of course by true world he's talking about metaphysics. Attainable for the sage, the pious, the virtuous man, he lives in it, he is it. The oldest form of the idea, relatively sensible, simple, and persuasive. A circumlocution for the sentence, "I, Plato, am the truth." He's talking about Plato here. Back in Plato, the highest form was the good, and we become good by knowing the good, for Plato. So when we know the good, when we are this true world, then we become virtuous. The next stage is the true world, attainable for now, unattainable for now, but promised for the sage, the pious, the virtuous man, for the sinner who repents. Progress of the idea, it becomes more subtle, insidious, incomprehensible, it becomes female, it becomes Christian. Sorry, I didn't write it. This is the next step. For Christians, the Christians take the Platonic idea and push it further out. For Plato, it might be difficult to attain this knowledge here, but it could be done. For the Christian, it can't be done. It waits until after death, into the next world. So it's moving further and further away. Now we get Kant. The true world, unattainable, indemonstrable, unpromisable, the noumena. This is the noumena. But the very thought of it, a consolation, an obligation, an imperative. At bottom, the old sun, but seen through myths and skepticism, the idea has become elusive, pale, Nordic, Königsbergian. Because Kant was from Königsberg. That's why he calls it Königsbergian. This is Kant. The noumena has even gotten further. It's mistier. It's like, it exists, we have to assume it exists, but I really can't know anything about it. But we're obligated by it, because without it, we can't explain the phenomena. Is the true world unattainable? Well, it's a question. At any rate, unattained, and being unattained, also unknown. Consequently, not consoling, redeeming, or obligating. How could something unknown obligate us? Now, this is the problem with Kant. I don't know anything about the noumena. How can I talk about it? And Kant talks about it a lot. He uses it, in fact. It's an important piece of his system to explain the phenomenon. But yet he claims it's unknowable and we can't talk about it. If it's unknowable, then just get rid of it. And that's what he does in the next step. The true world, now some quotes, an idea which is no longer good for anything, not even obligated. An idea which has become useless and superfluous. Consequently, a refuted idea. Notice that it's not refuted because it's false for Nietzsche. It's refuted because it's useless. Let us abolish it. Bright day, breakfast, return upon sin and cheerfulness. Plato's embarrassed blush, pandemonium of all free spirits. Now the true world is gone. Now God is gone. We have nothing. So what's left? The true world we have abolished. What world has remained? The apparent one perhaps, but no. Again, that's a reference to Plato, the appearance and the phenomena. But no, with the true world, we have also abolished the apparent one. Noon, moments of briefest shadow, end of the longest era, high point of humanity, and chickens are destroyed. Okay, it's all gone. Now we're left with nothing. The place Descartes is trying to avoid is where we're left. what we really got back there. It's kind of, because they couldn't get there. When Chippens are free spirit, now it's time for Nietzsche Superman to come onto the scene, because now we have nothing. And what's left without Superman? Yeah. How could anything originate out of its opposite? Notice the quotes at the beginning. This is Nietzsche quoting somebody else. How could anything originate out of its opposite? For example, truth out of error, or the will to truth out of the will to deception, or selfless deeds out of selfishness, or the pure and sunlight gaze of the sage out of lust. Such origins are impossible. Whoever dreams of them is a fool. Indeed worse, the things of highest value must have another peculiar origin. They cannot be derived from this transitory, seductive, deceptive, paltry world, from this turmoil of delusion and lust, rather from the lap of being, the intransitory, the hidden God, the thing in itself. There must be their basis and nowhere else. This way of judging constitutes the typical prejudgment and prejudice which give away the metaphysicians of all ages. This kind of valuation looms in the background of all their logical procedures. It is on account of this faith that they trouble themselves about knowledge, about something that is finally baptized solemnly as the truth. The fundamental faith of the metaphysicians is the faith of opposite values. It has not even occurred to the most cautious among them that one might have a doubt right here at the threshold where it is surely most necessary, even if they vow to themselves in omnibus dubitandum, without all things. For one may doubt first whether there are any opposites at all, and second, whether these popular valuations and opposite values on which the metaphysicians put their seal are not perhaps merely foreground estimates, only provisional perspectives, perhaps even from some nook, perhaps from below, far perspective as it were, to borrow an expression of energies. For all the value that the true, the truthful, the selfless may deserve, it would still be possible that a higher, more fundamental value for life might have to be ascribed to deception, selfishness, and lust. It might even be possible that what constitutes the value of these good and the great things is precisely that they are insidiously related, tied to and involved with these wicked, seemingly opposite things, maybe even one with them in essence. Maybe. But who has the will to concern himself with such dangerous maybes? But that one really has to wait for the advent of a new species of philosophers, such as have somehow or another in converse taste and propensity from those we have known so far, philosophers of the dangerous maybe in every sense. And in all seriousness, I see new philosophers coming up. So what does this mean? So the prejudice of the metaphysicians, the prejudice of philosophers up to this point, and actually up to the point of Descartes, to believe in opposite values. Being, non-being, true, false, good, evil. These oppositions were grounded in metaphysics, in the standard, the being that's out there. With the disappearance of this being, we have no more standard to distinguish true and false, being and not being, well, literally being and not being, since there's no being anymore, and good and evil. Where would we ground these ideas? Where would we ground these values? No place. So for us, the falseness of a judgment is not necessarily an objection to a judgment. In this respect, our new language may sound strange. The question is, to what extent is it life-promoting, life-serving, species-preserving, perhaps even species-cultivating? And we are fundamentally inclined to claim that the falsest judgments, which include the synthetic judgments a priori, are the most indispensable for us. That without accepting the fictions of logic, without measuring reality against the purely invented world of the unconditional and self-identical, without a constant falsification of the world by means of numbers, man could not live. That renouncing false judgments would mean renouncing life and a denial of life. To recognize untruth as a condition of life, that certainly means resisting accustomed value feelings in a dangerous way. And a philosophy that risked this would, by that token alone, place itself beyond good and evil. Falseness, truth, that doesn't matter. The highest value for Nietzsche, since we don't have, you know, any being to compare to establish our standard anymore, is life itself. But what is life? For Nietzsche, it's power. This is the will to power. The will to power is life. To exploit, to conquer, to overcome, strength. This is the value for Nietzsche. This is what life is. And that's what we have to preserve. Whatever's life-promoting, self-life-serving, species-preserving. Whatever preserves life, whether it's true or false, good or evil, that's what we need to follow. So where we left, we're left with nothing. What I relate is the history of the next 2 centuries. I describe what is coming, what can no longer come differently, the advent of nihilism. This history can be related even now, for necessity itself is at work here. This future speaks even now in 100 signs. This destiny announces itself everywhere. With this music of the future, all ears are cocked even now. For some time now, our whole European culture has been moving us toward a catastrophe, where the tortured tension that is growing from decade to decade, restlessly, violently, headlong, like a river that wants to reach the end, it no longer reflects, but is afraid to reflect. Where are we left? We're left with nothing, literally nothing. And for Nietzsche, we're going there. We're already there, in fact, because we've gotten to the point now where being itself has come into question. With Descartes, he tried to give a certainty of it, but he failed. Then Kant kind of tried to hold on to it with the noumena, but that didn't work very well. And now all these people are still trying to cling to it, and Nietzsche says, just give it up. It's a futile enterprise. Because you can't get there. The gap between me and being, if there is such a being, can't be bridged. There's no way to know it. So what we're left with is nothing. Now, he says it's coming, but it's actually already happened. The necessity is itself at work here. It's already happened. It happened way back with Descartes. So what do we do now? Well, the next person, the Superman, is going to have to reevaluate all these values. For one should make no mistake about the meaning of the title that this gospel of the future wants to bear. The Will to Power, attempt at a reevaluation of all values. In this formulation, a counter-movement finds expression regarding both principle and task, a movement that in some future will take the place of this perfect nihilism, but presupposes it logically and psychologically, and certainly can come only after and out of it. For why has the event of nihilism become necessary? Because the values we have had hitherto thus draw their final consequence. Because nihilism represents the ultimate logical conclusion of our great values and ideals, because we must experience nihilism before we can find out what value these values really have. We require sometime new values. If there's no God, then who's going to establish our values, our truth? Who's going to establish what's true and what's false? Where are we going to get that? We ourselves are going to have to create it. This is what he said back in the Mad Men. Do we not have to become gods to appear worthy of the deed? Well, if God dies, then who takes his place? We do. Well, then what does that mean? Well, then we're going to have to come up with our own values. The opposite of the thinker. And this is where we're at. And this is what postmodernism is, in my opinion. It's a view that questions knowledge in a fundamental way. It questions truth. It doubts truth. What can be true? Well, from an objective standpoint, there isn't one. There are no absolutes. I don't have the... What do you call it? The perspective to judge any other perspective. This is the incredulity towards meta-narratives. I don't have access to a meta-narrative that would allow me to talk about which narratives are valid and which aren't. So all I've got is my own narrative. And this is what I think Mr. Pitts, at the beginning in that article, failed to realize. Okay, Kim Thompson might be an idiot, but, you know, how can you show that he's wrong? How can you show that his position is false when you don't have an objective standard to compare it to? I can talk about all these authoritative sources like the Arlington National Cemetery all I want. But why should they be authoritative? What establishes their authority? The acceptance. In the end, the only thing wrong with Kim Thompson is the majority of people disagree with him. Just like the Holocaust deniers. You know, right now they're a fringe movement, but in about 50 or 100 years, when there's nobody left who's lived through the Holocaust, then who's going to say that they're not going to have a majority opinion? To the victor, to write history, well, That's kind of whoever's left at the end of the day. God is dead, we have killed him, and now we have to live with the consequences.
That's it. We have time for a few questions.
I hope I can do this without the microphone.
The ending of the ruler was very powerful because I was realizing that the issue was very important. The values of customers came from school are reflected. And if you went to the school of dream, it was pretty much all was being but the times began to change.
Okay. Okay. Is that a question?
Well, that's not observation.
Well, I don't know exactly what you mean by truth. Certainly, I think from a postmodern perspective, truth changes, or truth maybe it doesn't change, but it's not fixed. The correspondence theory of truth I was talking about earlier in the coherence theory of truth, we definitely live in a world now with coherence theory. And to be honest, let's trace back about to the mid-17th century, which is about the same time Descartes wrote this book. So about the time Descartes wrote it, the time the coherence theory starts being proposed, to correspond. Certainly truth can change depending on whether this statement's in this system or it's in this system. Ken Thompson's statement that there were Nazis fighting in World War I, well, in our system, that's pretty ridiculous. Is there a system where it might not be? There you go. There you go. And actually, Mr. Pence made a false statement because he said, until Harry Truman desegregated the army in 1948, blacks fought in Jim Crow units. Well, that wasn't true. In the American Revolution, there were no Jim Crow units.
Well, just because Euclidean geometry is no longer valid since Einstein, doesn't mean that I'm lying to you when I give you a carbon estimate.
Well, to talk about whether somebody's lying or not is to put yourself in a perspective where God's not yet dead.
But God was never alive in the first place, by definition. So how can you say he was dead? I mean, that's like saying a two-dimensional square does not exist in a three-dimensional world. It doesn't exist. It's an abstraction. God is by definition an abstraction.
Okay, well, as soon as you take away that metaphysical... What's the word I'm looking for? I don't like pain.
Well, geometry is no longer valid, but I can still make an estimate for your
carpet. Okay. Because it's useful.
I mean, God will still make good tests for whatever he is. It doesn't matter whether he exists or not. The idea of God is to make good peasants.
The idea of God is to make good peasants?
Exactly.
Catherine, tell me something.
Self-life insurance.
Okay. I've got a question about the idea that you can't trust yourself. Can my senses don't give me the knowledge that the sun's, I see that it's that big, but man has to learn the knowledge, oh, the sun's 93 billion miles away, and that kind of distance, it looks this big, or the straw of water, it looks big because particles travel through air at different speed than they do through water, so we can trust our senses.
Okay. Well, let's see how we'll get it now. You can basically trust whatever you want.
Well, you trust reality, you trust your senses, you trust objective measure of science. You don't trust...
Well, do they have an absolute measure of truth? Do they have what the entire cause, he calls it rules of legitimation. Discourses on how we establish rules that legitimate knowledge, the body of knowledge. Where do those rules to legitimate something come from? Where do the rules to legitimate perception or experience as a source of knowledge come from?
It's up to man to start it.
Okay. Well, then if it's up to me, then somebody's refusal to learn it is no more legitimate or illegitimate than somebody else's willingness to learn.
That's incorrect. I don't want to fly an airplane where the guy refused to learn how airplanes fly, or a restaurant, or clean food, or clean water.
Even though now airplanes do very little flying, it's all...
It's fair. Okay.
The two different kinds of truth here, I think. We're talking about moral truth, ethical truth, which may be situational or depending on time and place. But then there's, absolute reality too. Does it exist beyond or independent of what we think or feel or if we're even here? If the tree falls in the forest, there is a sound whether I hear it or not. And on planets, on others, around other stars, the rules of physics and chemistry apply whether I existed or thought.
They do?
So I think that there is, absolute reality, maybe not absolute truth, moral truth. There are two different kinds of truth here. What do you
think? Okay, well, what makes you think there's an absolute moral reality?
Well,
where do you get that idea from?
This is an absurd consumer of their lives. Everything is a practical decision that ends on size. Says, sure, this is the world that exists in the world.
Well, I've got these.
Stay together here, please.
Maybe.
Bishop, please finish your statement.
Well, truth is always a practical matter. I mean, as you say, this food is edible. That means there's a 99.99% chance of whole doubt. I don't know that for sure. I mean, everything has a sense of the word being true. And the idea, and two, it's the fundamental notion that you must not assent to anything that is 100% knowable is in itself an absurd position.
Okay.
So we assume the external world is.
Yeah, but you just used the critical word.
Well, external is just the
word. Not assuming.
Yes, of course, but assuming is the only rational way an entity can proceed.
Then why can't I assume something contrary?
Because it's absurd, and there's no practical.
What establishes the absurdity of
it? The absurdity.
What's the standard that determines this is absurd and this is not?
Absurdity are the the predictable consequences that are carefully aware. You walk around and think the external world doesn't exist, and you spend your time thinking about that, you degenerate into the spiral of no knowledge.
Okay, you go off to that. Way in the back there.
With this line of reason, these are the things that they're considering the human factors. Basically, the static entities involved.
Human matter is static? Not necessarily. I don't see why it would be static. We can change our views, we can change truth, or we can change what we believe, basically, at will.
We can change.
Like it?
Well, yeah, sure.
That, to have anything fixed, is a problem.
I'm just going to say, this is not a reason God keeps the closest.
I don't think so. I think it's exactly the opposite. But nothing is fixed, nothing is static.
Any questions here? Ken, I'm going to agree with this table over here with one modification. Is that people act on perception. So whether or not it is true or not that my car can get me in Colorado, if I perceive that it can get me to Colorado, I'll get my car, I can drive to Colorado, and as far as I'm concerned, that's true, because I perceive that to be the case, and all the evidence points to the fact that my perception was accurate. Okay? So, I mean, you can metaphysically talk about what truth is, but you're going to act on perception.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Okay. So perception perceives something to be true.
We act on what our perception of truth is. The question is, what validates that belief?
Predictive ability. If I perceive something to be true, if I do this, that's going to happen, and I do that, and then that does happen, my perception is accurate.
By what standard do you establish predictability as a value?
Observational measurement.
Experience.
Why should I care? Okay, it's predictable. Big deal.
What did you have a question earlier?
My question was, have you looked at or do you have an opinion about how postmodern thought has affected religion, the great religions of the world? Have you noticed a particular...
I have a book at home, and I'm sure, I think one of the speakers here was Daryl Bach, that was talking about postmodernism. I don't see how in a postmodern world, without some kind of absolute standard, you can maintain religion. But there are things that people do,
Buddhism.
Yeah, there's still that it's a nihilistic kind of thing, but it's still a standard. There's still a there's something
other than James, they're in migration, they're almost to the last migration, and they have built it up.
But there's that last migration that everybody's trying to get to, or trying to get to.
Okay, Russell, you have to give the last question.
You've traced the descent to nihilism, and it seems to me it points up that you need, in order to get out of nihilism, you need to set faith in something, whether it's science, nihilism would predict that there's a certain amount of faith in that. Whether it's false religion, it would still be an unavoidable faith.
Okay.
And I think that it's a matter of what perceived. In other words, ultimate nihilism, the fact that you could conceive of doubt on anything you put out there, doesn't destroy the opposite. In fact, that you could be doubtful. In other words, so this is an exercise in pointing out ways to doubt anything. And that's just what it seems to me that it points up that it's not so much a deal between naturalism, which is espouses empiricalism, and versus faith, or versus theism.
No, I don't disagree with you. They're two different narratives. I mean, we've got two different systems of thought. And the whole point of postmodernism is that there's no way to judge between them anymore. So if you want to be an atheist, if you want to value predictability, fine, go ahead. I can't say anything against it. I don't have the standard to look at it and judge it from. there is no God's idea. There is no, that's why it means that God's dead.
I would add, I'm fallible, but if it's a God and I'm getting information from him, then that's an unfallible source.
Okay.
When it comes to a fallible person.
Okay.
So that means it's inconceivable for me or a reflection of me to be able to kill God.
Well, if he's not actually talking about taking a knife and sticking it in the heart of God, you know, God's only goes
blood. He was changing the concept. It's just what he's talking about, what Nietzsche must be talking about is a group of intellectuals that would like to think that way because they define God as something less than absolute being.
Well, now defining him as a being at all, absolute or not, is what the problem is. Because we don't have any way to have knowledge of that being. It is impossible to know anything about that being. And that's Nietzsche's point. If we can't know anything about it, if we don't have any knowledge of it, then what purpose does it serve?
That's
just a assumption. Let's give a round of applause.